Good evening, fellow indie artists. This is Jay Michaels with Mary Elizabeth McCarry.
Hello.
Here in the Passion Pit. We're coming to the end of the year, and this will be our last interview program for 2018. Speaking of 2018, the music you hear behind me is from NPR's list of the best of the music of 2018. This is not the end of our season, if you will. Next week, we will have a coming attractions program. So if you got something going on in 2019, let me know about it, and we'll talk all about it here. December will also be the time that I begin bugging Broadway producers, fellow indie artists, including playwrights, actors, musicians, and other talented folk for new interviews that will appear in 2019. Today, I'm thrilled to spotlight two buddies who coincidentally are authors. First is author, educator, and journalist Patrick Hickey. Patrick wrote a book that is flying off the shelves, The Mind Behind the Games, which has become the definitive tome of video game creators and their stories. Patrick is also the editor-in-chief of ReviewFix, one of the leading pop culture sites and one of the most dedicated supporters of us indie folk. Patrick is also a voice artist and a really nice guy. Here he is.
Hello.
Patrick Hickey.
How you doing?
Very well. This is Jay Michaels. As you can tell, this line is being recorded for quality assurance. Welcome.
This line is welcome. Being recorded.
I knew I was going to have a good time. I knew this was going to be a good one. This is going to be for the podcast, and we are speaking to Patrick Hickey Jr., educator, entrepreneur, editor-in-chief and founder of one of the leading pop culture sites online, ReviewFix, and the author, or shall we say, the mind behind The Mind of the Games, what is becoming like the leading book on video game creators. Welcome aboard, Patrick. Tell us about yourself. You yourself have a very interesting story. Tell us about yourself. Tell us about the book and all else in your universe.
So, I, as you said, so eloquently and beautifully as only you can, my name is Patrick Hickey Jr. I'm the author of The Minds Behind the Games, interviews with cult and classic video game developers. I'm also the assistant director of the journalism program at Kingsborough Community College and the chairman of the CUNY Journalism Discipline Council. So,
in addition, that's new.
Yeah, that's new. That's about 2 weeks. That's been a title for the past 2 weeks. So, really cool.
Man.
Yeah. Wow. And, I'm also a voice actor and a story writer in the video game industry. I'm currently writing the story for a game called Treason in Space, and I have four voice acting credits under my belt right now. One is for Treason in Space, the other one is for the Caillou Offensive, and then the last two are for Relentless Rex and The Padre.
Let's talk about that really quick, because I had the joy of doing a voice for a video game. I did it for King's Quest.
Oh, wow.
They did like a new chapter called Silver Lining, and I got to play Shadrach, and it was great. I showed up to a studio in like sweatpants and sat in front of a microphone with a script and just went, I shall get you! And it was great. And then they paid me and I walked away. It was wonderful. How was it to voice act? That's a new thing for you. That's not, that's new to your portfolio. Yeah.
Yeah. I started doing it in October of 2017. The way it came about was pretty crazy. It was, I got asked to interview a developer for my site, and I did it, and then they asked me if I wanted to play the game, and I did, and then I noticed that there were some grammatical deficiencies in the writing of the story. So I said, if you guys want, let's talk. I can edit the entire story of your game. So they said yes, so now I'm on board, and editing story as it comes along. The game was very much a work in progress, but I mean, it was just beautiful. It's like, it looked like Minecraft, but had like the story of like Alone in the Dark. So it was like this scary game with like really cool, a cool visual allure to it. So we're getting ready to go to Kickstarter, and our voice actor leaves.
Oh, that's great.
So, and, it's supposed to be a scary game, but the guy sounded like Russell Brand. So it was like, this little wacky English man just rolling through like a, you know, a castle and oh my god. And I'm just like, nah, this voice doesn't match. So I'm like, I could do it. And they're like, what? I'm like, yeah, I can do it. So I went in my man cave, and anyone that knows me knows that I can do that. You know, in a world, one man, one tortilla, starring Danny DeVito as the tortilla. Like that deep movie trailer voice. And I'm like, I can't use that. And I'm like, I wanted to give them that English, you know, aspect of it too. So I love Jeremy Irons, and there's a lot of actors that I like that have like a very dark, like English voice. So I kind of combine the two.
Now, when I came up with the padre, as I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, and this very dark English voice,
and they ate it up. And I would say it was like 45 minutes after I sent them in some samples, they were like, "Can you record everything?"
Oh, that's gorgeous.
And I was like, yeah, dude, let's do it. So then, you know, we're doing trailers, and I did all the Kickstarter stuff. And then, I mean, that game is, there's a lot of stuff I can't talk about with the game because
sure.
we signed with a publisher and there's a non-disclosure, but everything's going really good. So, I mean, it's on Steam right now, but there's a lot of crazy stuff that's going on. All good stuff, no bad stuff.
Of
and
course.
After that, I kind of went to my wife and I'm like, I really enjoyed this and I don't want to be, you know, like a one-hit wonder. So then I started reaching out to other developers and got on one project that way. And then another one, I was on a podcast with a game developer who, you know, met me through the book. And he had this idea for a game. And we had this long conference call about it. And Peepaw Cat, awesome guy. He's worked in film and gaming. And he was like, this is my idea for a story. And it was pretty general, but it was like a really solid idea. And he's like, all right, so now you're the writer, so you build the world. Like, you name the characters, you build the backstory,
wow.
everything. And I'm like, oh, my God. And I'm not a fiction writer. I'm a nonfiction writer, but I always wanted to write fiction, you know? So I'm like, yeah, I'm definitely doing this. And then they're like, oh, yeah, we want you to voice, like, the wise-ass robot character. I'm like, oh, this is awesome. Okay. So then that was that. And then a couple months ago, I signed on as a story editor and narrator in this really cool game called the Caillou Offensive, which is basically like Rampage. You're just this monster and you just destroy shit, and it's so much fun, and I'm the narrator, so it's like when you lose, I'm like, loser. So
that's great.
Winner. So like when people have been writing on Twitter, like, I feel like when I die I have to play the game again because I want to hear the guy say winner, and like, the guy that says loser is so freaking annoying, blah blah blah. It's like, that's the point. You know, so it's the voice acting stuff basically came about from after I wrote the book. I was like the Grinch. Instead of my heart growing two sizes too big, my balls grew two sizes too big.
Nothing wrong with that.
And I'm like, you know what? I always wanted to write a book, and I did it. And then I'm like, I always wanted to do voice acting. And then this opportunity came about, and I'm like, you know what? I'm doing it. So yeah, the last like 2 years of my life have been pretty wild between having a child and then doing all of this stuff. So yeah, I haven't been this happy like ever in my entire life as far as like creatively. I feel like I'm at the most creative I've ever been in my entire life.
That is terrific. That is true. You bring up 2 points about the British accent. It seems every villain has to have a British accent somewhere.
Yeah, it's just sexier.
I loved in the old movies, even the Nazis, everybody spoke British. I just wondered why you British. Even I'm sure you remember the TV series Farscape.
Yeah,
and Farscape, all the peacekeepers were British. Mm-hmm. I just thought, okay, yeah, well, whatever. And as for writing fiction, if you are a comic book lover, if you're a game lover,
yes.
please,
yes.
your fantasy brain is kicked mm-hmm. in there. And speaking of games, tell us about this book, which is Riding the Crest of the Wave. Tell us about the book. I know there's even a sequel coming out.
Yes, the sequel. I just finished my 22nd chapter, like right before
oh my
you called.
Gosh.
So the first, it's. To sum it up, like, easily, to make it more palatable, it's an interview anthology. So it's 36 chapters. Each chapter focuses on the creative process behind a video game. So you got 36 chapters in the first book. It's 36 games from Doom, NBA Jam, Deus Ex, Wasteland, NHL, hockey. Like, there's something. Where in the world is Carmen Sandiego? There's something for everyone there. So I've done all the hard work of reaching out to all of these developers and finding them and actually getting them to tell me the story behind the game. So it's a lot of fun. I'm a college professor, but I don't write like one. I write like a journalist, and I write like somebody that wants to connect to as many people as possible. So
yeah,
I just spoke at a elementary school today, in front of, like, it was crazy, 150 kids from, like, pre-K to fifth grade. And I told them, I feel like next year for a lot of you, when you get into sixth and seventh grade, this book will be perfect for you. Because, I mean, you know, fourth, fifth grade, their reading level may not be there. But I think, like, a 12, 13-year-old kid can totally go, oh, my God, I didn't know all this went into video games. And that's the point, to show what went into these games. I'm a big fan of history. That's what my minor was in Brooklyn College. And there was a quote from Robert the Bruce. And he said, the former king of Scotland back in the day.
Back in the day.
You know, and he said that history is written by the men who hang the heroes. And I just
wow. Myself,
yeah. It's a pretty powerful statement, you know. And I just thought, like, video game developers don't get to tell their story at all. Even, like, once they die, like, a lot of people just don't care, or they don't know why they should care. So I just felt like it would be important to video game history and to, like, any scholarly and academic, you know, that is looking to write about video game history at some point, or any journalist, to have all of these interviews, like, in the Library of Congress, in book form. So this way people can look back and find out what inspired these games, because the information on Wikipedia is a joke.
Of course.
A lot of the blog stuff is a joke. So it's like I said, I did all the hard work, and I made it as easy to read and fun for everyone. So that's kind of like what I was going for.
See, now I love that. I've been regaling my classes also since Stan Lee passed away. Mm-hmm. The last couple of days, I've been talking about the genesis, if you will, on how these characters were created. Mm-hmm. And there's amazing stories of how he used to sit in the bullpen at Marvel Comics, and they would just say words to each other. Shirk, mm-hmm. Fleep, Blip. And if something mm-hmm. sounded great, they'd turn it into a monster or a superhero.
Yeah.
Hence the Guardians of the Galaxy's Groot. When I say that to people, some people go, oh, that's cool. So, some people just look out the window. Why should we care? You know, okay, we're watching. We love the game. We're playing the game. Why do we want to know about the game developer? What helps us enjoy the game by knowing that?
It's like what I was just talking to these elementary school kids. I said, you know, Max Payne, it's like one of the highest grossing video games in the past 15 years, was actually inspired by ancient Greek mythology. Thor, Loki, you know, Odin. So it's kind of like we've been told our entire lives that if you play video games, you're an idiot. But truth be told, really smart people make video games, and they're inspired by stuff that we've all had some kind of interaction with. We all know Thor and Loki sure. and Odin, but we don't know them in the same aspect as these guys. These guys really know their mythology. You know, you play the game and you go, oh, wow, I know where you're going here. You know, they're impacted by anime, they're impacted by music, but they're also impacted by moments they had with their family. They're much more human than we make them out to be. Sure, they're nerds and stuff like that, but they're actually real people affected by the things that happened in their lives to the point where they went out and created art that affected millions of people. Huh. You know? So again, it's not just, oh yeah, you play video games and your brain will rot. Some of these guys have made a tremendous living doing it. And some people, they're not even in the video game industry anymore. One of the guys gives mountain tours in Canada.
Well, that's a little different, yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, so it's just like I wanted people to look at these developers as real people, as people that have had some type of impact on pop culture, because they have. Video games are the highest grossing form of pop culture in the world right now. You know, it was like another thing, too. It's like I've had professors that I work with say that my work is an academic. Mm-hmm. That it's not scholarly. And to me, that's basically like the same people that said film didn't matter 80, 90 years ago. And now you have film studies courses.
Right.
You have literature and film courses. Right now there's a video game journalism class offered at NYU.
Brilliant.
10 years from now, I'm going to look a lot smarter than I am right now. And right. I'm already pretty smart.
And you're looking pretty smart as from where I'm sitting. So you're basically saying that people talk about video games and say, ugh, it's nothing, it's for children. But when you dig into them, when you listen to the people that created them, you're hearing literature, you're hearing life, you're hearing history, you're hearing mythology, you're hearing all the things that they consider legitimate subjects to discuss.
Absolutely. It's like anyone that plays a game like Celeste or a game like Red Dead Redemption 2 and doesn't see how smart those games are, then you're just like one of the most miserable people in the world. Then you have it's like zero fun. Then why are you even here? What's the point? You know,
there's a book that I read years ago called Up, Up and Oy Vey. And mm-hmm. it's a book about the early comic book artists and how they were all children of immigrants and how everything from Superman to Captain America, these were parables that these children, as they grew, created these superheroes. And as much as you might say Superman has nothing to do with anything but science fiction, it was a parable at that point about Moses. It has since become a Christ-like parable. Captain America, again, his creators were children of immigrants. And it's about the way they rationalized the fact they had to escape from their own countries. When I mention this to younger people, suddenly, no matter what their ethnicity is, they suddenly look up and realize that a child of an immigrant created this universe. Mm-hmm. Do you think, now your book is going to obviously make video games like fine wine. People are going to be able to look at them and see the real quality underneath them. Do you think it's also going to be an inspiration? Do you think people are going to look and say, if he did, now I'm sitting at my computer and I'm going to do it?
I hope so. I mean, I was on a double date like last week and I was talking about my book to somebody and they're a big fan of video games and their wife was like, oh, you should write a book about video games. And he was just like, yeah, okay. You know how much work that is? Like he understood the work that I put into it and why it was important. So it's like I like to hit both of those. So one of the main reasons why I wrote the book was because I was impacted by people like Brett Weiss and Leonard Herman and Ken Horowitz, people that were already writing similar books, but in a different way. Like Ken Horowitz is a pure historian. Brett Weiss is a journalist, but he writes, you know, more reference style books. And Leonard Herman is a pure historian. Like you could kill somebody with his book, Phoenix. Like it's so big, you know, and I wanted to write in a more palatable style. Like I literally want my book to be on top of your toilet bowl. Ugh. Like I want you to take it into your bathroom. I want you to take it into your bedroom and read it before you go to bed. Like start from like the middle of the book and work your way back. Like it's picked up to get dog-eared, you know? So
it's so funny.
I'm trying to write for everybody.
The toilet bowl line, when you said that, I blinked. I was like, what? But then I suddenly realized the brilliance of that alone. Of course, there it is. It is the go-to book. It is wherever I am, I need to learn. Mm-hmm.
if you take a book or a game on your phone into the bathroom with you, it's good.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So. That is the 21st century, you know, praise. Where did you read
that?
In the bathroom.
In the bathroom.
One day you have to simply do that voice. You have to do that voice for your classes.
Today, oh, I do it all the time.
It's the final.
I do it all the time. I take attendance like that sometimes. Like, you know, they think I'm an idiot, but they love it at the same time.
And that's why people show up to your class.
What is he going to do next?
Let's like the Howard Stern there. Yeah, really. So you essentially, you're echoing what I was saying in the sense that you read these people's books and said, no, now it's my turn and I'm going to put my spin, my brain on that.
Absolutely. So, and that's why I reached out to Brett Weiss to write the foreword for the first book. And he helped a lot. He gave it a lot of credibility. And then for book two, Leonard Herman is going to write the foreword. So yeah, it's like while I was writing the book, I reached out to all of those guys. I had never met them. And I offered to interview them for Review Fix, which was a really underhanded, sneaky way of getting to pick their brain.
Of course.
You know?
Of course.
And it totally helped. It totally helped me write my book. But then also I began to follow them on Facebook and Twitter, and I saw the way that they were marketing themselves, and I'm a complete marketing whore. So I helped them, and I've had a lot of help in marketing from some person. I don't know who, but just some guy, you know. I think, what's his name? Oh my god, he's got a really cool mustache. You, there you go.
Pleasure. So are you kidding? I think it's amazing what you're doing. So it's far too much fun.
Thank you.
Speaking of being involved, anybody not wanted to be involved? Anyone gave you opposition that just said, leave me the hell alone, I've had enough already, or whatever?
A ton. When they found out that I was writing a book about video games, it's like, why? Why do it? Oh, it's not scholarly. It's not academic. I've had people at meetings that I obviously wasn't at say that my work shouldn't be considered eligible for promotion.
Oh.
And things like that. But again, there's a big difference between the usual, you know, academic writing fair and what I write. And you know what that is?
Who wants to pick it up and read it, maybe?
Yeah, my work is actually read.
There you go.
So,
there you go.
So, yeah. So, I mean, that's the thing, too. There's a lot of people in this world, and it's not just in the academic sphere. There's a lot of people in this world that want to see you succeed, but they don't want to see you succeed past a certain level.
Of course.
So I'm the first person in my family to go to college. I'm the first person in my family that has never tried or has been addicted to any types of drugs or alcohol.
Oh.
So I'm the classic overachiever. When everyone else that stands in my way is sleeping, I'm still writing. I have a baby monitor next to my side the entire time. And I do what I have to do every single day. I don't waste a day. I eat too much. I don't take care of myself. But mentally, I'm sharper than a tack. And I'm ready to do this, what I'm doing now, for like the next 45 years.
It's funny that the word overachiever, people tend to mean that somewhat negatively or dubiously.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's great. Maybe yeah. Your work will be read. Hello. Mm-hmm. There's the story. Michael Grunwald, as long as we're talking ancient history, as you were talking, Robert the Bruce, Michael Grunwald wrote the most comprehensive biography, and this is going back to the days of the Renaissance, the mm-hmm. most comprehensive biography on Richard III, and no one will read it because mm-hmm. they read Shakespeare's play, and that's who Richard III is to them.
Yeah.
Now, if you hear the actual story, Richard III was just this paranoid king with scoliosis. But mm-hmm. but we look at him because of the accessible William Shakespeare. So, mm-hmm. okay, let's have all those nice scholastic books up on the shelf, and they look really pretty, but no one's going to read them. Yours is the one that ends up in the bathroom, but ends yep. up on everyone's mind as well.
And see, that's the thing, though, too, because I have the academic background, I can have all of that history and all of that, you know, all of that stuff that gives the book value, but I can deliver it in a way where people still want to read it. That's the important part.
For sure. You're one of us, as mm-hmm. one of my students once said. So let's talk about Review Fix quickly, which is how I first met you. I think it's so daring. You have this amazing site that grabs, and if we're talking about your brain and we're talking about, you know, academia, if you will, it talks theater, film, TV, video games, pro wrestling. It's funny, you look at it, you just say, huh, what? It's the salad bar of pop culture, of things that fascinate our brains. How did that get started?
It's so funny because I started in 2009 because I was ending a 6-year relationship, and I was like, I need something to focus my time and energy on. So I started it that way. And then just moving forward, I continued to build writers, and I just basically wanted to write about all of the things that I love. And I remember in 2011, I went to try and get funding. And one of the editors, the former editors of Entertainment Weekly, said, no site that covers this many things would ever succeed.
Oh, really?
And 9 years later, it was still around. And now if you look at like IGN, GameSpot, all these places, they cover everything now.
Sure.
So I feel like I did a good job of being ahead of the game. So
I was going to say, you're so progressive, because now there's no such thing as choosing a major, if you will. Now it's about knowing all of these things. You get people who are writing, directing, producing. It's not like, okay, I'm just doing this one thing. So for you to cover all of this, that's what people want. That's what people need.
Absolutely. Jay, I'm really sorry to do this, but as you can hear, my daughter just woke up.
That's a good reason.
And I'm home by myself.
And so I'm going to say, Patrick, thank you so much for this interview. Go take care of your daughter,
problem.
Who's your greatest achievement right there.
Yes, absolutely.
And I will tell on the program where you can order the book and all the other good things, and to look for Mind of the Games 2. And needless to say, I wish you all the luck in the world, and I look forward to seeing you on campus where we can bullshit about all the things going on.
Thank you so much, good sir. Always a pleasure to be on.
Same here. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Bye.
That was great. That was great. Thank you, Patrick. Before we get to our second guest, I want to introduce my partner in life and crime, Mary Elizabeth McCary, who will share some amazing news about her next musical masterpiece. Mary?
Yes? How can I help you?
Tell us all about what it means to sing about being high.
Well, my idea of doing a, this exploration and curating songs from about 1910 to about 1950 that are in not in the American Songbook, but in my opinion should be, which are a lot of vaudeville and bohokum or silly kind of jokey blues that not a lot of people know a lot about. There are albums out there that include these things, but they're not very well known. So we've already finished about two and maybe 2.5 years of working through the Dirty Songbook from the old blues era, songs by so many people like Bessie Smith and Mae West and Sophie Tucker and Clara Thompson and Clarence Williams, et cetera, et cetera. So now we're on to the next bunch, and we have curated about 20 or so songs all about marijuana.
That is terrific.
Yeah, in 1910 until 1950 or so, or a little after, marijuana was legal in the United States and became illegal and then became a controlled substance under Richard Nixon's regime. So before that, people were very happy to sing about the joys of getting high, using weed, gauge, ganja, what else do they call it? Tea, all these other things. It was kind of a common thing, and people would sing about being vipers, or a viper, and smoking and getting, you know, relaxed and chill and all these kind of great adjectives way before Snoop Dogg ever thought about doing that. So
there's one lyric I loved where it's, I'm sitting on my lawn smoking tea.
Right, tea.
That was great.
That's what they called it, tea. So that's going to be happening in April 6th at Pangea in New York City, which is a wonderful Italian restaurant in the East Village. And we'll give you more information as that gets closer. And so we just started, you know, putting together stuff, finding keys and clues and history and all kinds of information, and hired my band, and we're ready to go.
Do you think this is like an auspicious year for it? Everybody's talking about legalizing marijuana. So are you jumping aboard something? Are you in the front line of something coming up?
Well, I'm not in the front line. I'm actually in the back of the line, going back to the 1920s, where it was a different kind of a situation where it was legal and people were using it for recreational purposes as well as medicinal purposes. We know in New York City, where we are, it is legal for medicinal purposes. So that's great. So I've heard through the people who do use medicinal marijuana, that they're being told by their pharmacist that it's any day now that it's going to become legal in New York State. So it's a wonderful thing, and it does help not only people who are sick, but also people who grow weed. So
that's terrific. We're going to hear more about it next week for the upcoming attractions show, and we'll hear more about it between now and April.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, finally, I want to introduce a colleague, friend, and mentor. Gary Morgenstein is the PR wizard behind, are you ready for this, Sharknado. He's an amazing artist in his own right as well. His plays have garnered accolades, awards, and future interest. And now his sci-fi sports novel, that's right, a sci-fi sports novel, is also the hot ticket for those interested in science fiction and other fantastical journeys. Here's Gary.
Mr. Michaels, how are you, sir?
Very well. How are you?
Wonderful. Happy Wednesday.
Thank you. Same to you. It's only been about a million years since I spoke to you.
I know, really.
We're on a recorded line for quality assurance, so our banks know that we're doing everything all right.
Okay, fine.
So you're a celebrity in my eyes. You went from being on the Sci-Fi Channel handling promotion, and now you are a celebrated, and I'm not using that word lightly, you are a celebrated author of both plays and novels. So tell us what's going on.
Well, A Mound Over Hell, my science fiction baseball novel, came out late spring, and it's kind of unique in that it's a dystopian view using baseball as a centrality to a new world where America in 2098 has lost World War III to Islam. If you want to talk about the nightmare, yes. Actually, I came up with the idea a few years ago. My wife, Marcina, and I were having Sunday breakfast, listening to the Beatles and eating everything bagels with a schmear. And I, you know, of course, I mean, what else, you know, motivates a Jewish writer?
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is a commercial for New York. And now back to our show.
There we go. There we go. And I hope everyone outside beyond the George Washington Bridge knows what, you know, that means. But I hope so in this day and age. Anyway.
I'm going to get listeners who said, what's a schmear?
Well, yeah, you know, you got to look it up. Come on. You got to look it up. We're beautifying them one Gentile at a time. And I thought, well, what about a novel where baseball has its final season ever in a dystopian America led by someone named Grandma? I thought, well, that's a pretty cool idea, but now what? And so I created a whole world, and I wanted to explore what happens when America is no longer great and no longer free, because sadly there's nothing fixed in stone, that empires stay empires. Just as the British, the Romans, the Greeks, right?
Yeah, really. Anyone we study in history, that's a really interesting parable. As you say it, even though I've heard about this for the longest time, it's a really interesting parable. You're taking the ultimate American institution and ending it. So it really is that parable about the fall of an empire when you get right down to it.
And baseball represents the America, the nostalgic America, but now it's associated with treason.
And
except baseball recovers.
Wow. And no spoiler alert. Don't tell me what happens at the end.
No.
It's really interesting because your career in marketing and public relations has shown you've picked something with a massively powerful demographic. You're talking baseball. You're talking science fiction. You're talking politics. You've handed us one novel that hits so many hot button topics. That's really great. You're a sci-fi lover, I'm going to gather.
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
You had two plays that I know of that did really well, and both of them had a fantasy element, and then obviously this novel does. Tell me about your plays. Tell me about Mad Mel and even more timely Saving Stan.
Well, we are pushing. We had Mad Mel Saves the World, a sci-fi musical, in a workshop production at the Manhattan Theater Festival back in the summer of 2017, and now we are taking it to the next level. Just finished the sizzle reel. We'll send it out to producers very shortly.
Is that right? Oh, that's great. You did it at the Midtown International. That's wonderful. Oh, I'm glad to hear
I'll
that.
I'll send you the sizzle reel. I'd love to
Please. I would love to see
it. It's a lot of fun. Yes. And Saving Stan had a workshop production at the Broadway Bound Festival.
Right.
And now I'm pushing that to get that up again. And I'm also working on a musical of King David, which I don't know if I've discussed with you yet.
No,
so,
you didn't. Oh, there we go. This is we have an exclusive, ladies and gentlemen.
Exclusive.
Wow.
That is an exclusive. Well, I'm working with a composer out in California. You know, it's amazing that King David has never been done as a play. It's been Disney tried to do bits of it and in a kind of a concert back in the 90s, but it is just such a fascinating story, from shepherd boy to king to tormented king. And the many flaws, I mean, Bathsheba, his immorality in the pursuit of power, his struggles with his faith in God, uniting the Jewish people, only fail, you know, at the end, not ever seeing the temple rebuilt. Solomon, his son, took that over. But it's just, you talk about parables and flawed heroes or flawed anti-heroes. And I think it's the most wondrous story in the Bible, and really, at the end of the day, everyone has used David. It's, everyone who ever tells a story has some element of David. So I thought, okay, let's do this. So she's working on the music now.
Oh, that's
cool. It should be kind of fun. Yeah, and you want to get it, you want to contemporize it. I mean, that's the balance. You want to be faithful to the faith, but you also want to make it contemporary. You know, there's like, there's some questions about him and Jonathan. Did they have a relationship?
Mm.
And of course, you know, so you've got to, you know, this is 2019. You must touch upon that. So some people might think it's a little edgy, but you can't overlook that. But yet you want to be true to the music, and you want to have a harp because of David's harp. So it's a fascinating endeavor, and I think taking it from A to Z is the only way to do it.
That's a really bold move. I see things with President Kennedy all the time, and when you look at biopics and documentaries on John Kennedy in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s all the way through to today, you see how our modern thinking takes over we go from this almost saint all the way through to this flawed king who, who, if you've watched The Crown, the TV series The Crown, Kennedy does not look that brilliant in that series as well. So you're kind of doing the same thing. You're basically taking this beyond legend and showing us the human element of it.
Well, yes, and at the end of the day, if you tell a story, it's got to be about a human being. And I think we are so worried nowadays in our politically correct culture to show good and bad people as human beings. There was a movie that came out, you know, I'm a big movie buff, movie that came out maybe 10 years ago called The Bunker, which showed Hitler in the last days of the bunker in Berlin. And the New York Times gave it a scathing review because they said you humanized Hitler by showing him eating ravioli. Now, I have a headline for everyone. Hitler could eat. Hitler had to eat. It doesn't matter if you're good or bad, you must still perform basic human functions. And we're not going to list them all, but I think your audience knows them.
Yeah.
And when you if you're telling stories, if you're a playwright, a novelist, you must show good and bad as people. Because we cannot, even just on a broader scale, we cannot understand how evil mutates unless we see that it came from human beings. Adolf Hitler did not come from Mars. And, right? And so when you tell stories, I love John Kennedy. He was flawed. There were many flaws. All our leaders, who becomes president? Forget who becomes president. Who wants to become president? Who wants to be a politician without having deep flaws, almost as bad as wanting to be a writer and have people say, oh, aren't you wonderful, a performer, right? there's something a little off in your psyche. So you have to, there's nothing wrong with exploring that, but we have to be allowed to. People get crazy.
You even do that in Saving Stan because the premise, I'll give nothing away, but the premise is this man who is in a wheelchair. Correct me if I'm wrong, he has a stroke. And he's debilitated so completely. And through the mystical thing that you have within the play, he basically asks his friend to kill him.
Yes.
And again, as the story goes on, we see just, you know, we get a ne'er-do-well friend and we get this brilliant pillar of business and we watch how the lines blur between them just as we find out the backstory, which is great.
Yeah, because, you know, there's that thin line. Between, I mean, everyone, even the best of us, and we're, you know, good people. And most people are good people, though, no matter what you see, you know, in the media. I mean, most human beings just want to get by and have a laugh and, you know, be healthy and have their kids healthy and have a living and on. But everyone does something wrong several times in their lives.
Duh.
And and they're probably ashamed of it. But that doesn't mean that you're bad. I think Shakespeare talked about, it was the opacity of Shakespearean characters because he could have characters who were good and noble suddenly doing like, what did you just do? That's terrible. But people do that. But that's good drama. That's why people, you know, this is not a Marvel superhero. This is like real human beings. And even, you know, the good Marvel superheroes are tormented.
Yeah, I was going to say you might Marvel characters in, you know, as we talk about Stan Lee's passing, Marvel characters were all human beings. Spider-Man was just a dweeby kid from Queens.
That's right. And that would made it work. I mean, I always preferred Marvel comics because I felt like everyone loves Superman. He's boring. I'm sorry.
Yeah, really.
He's boring. And, you know, now they try to humanize him, apparently, in the comics, because he has a son. So that's like his new kryptonite, you know, something will happen to his son. But he's still boring. Batman, at least, was brooding, you know, the Hulk on and on. But that's good literature.
Completely.
You know, someone said good versus evil is farce, but good versus good is tragedy. And, you know, I think that's why people want to read books and go to the movies.
That's really interesting. I like that. Good versus good. Yeah, it's funny that the ultimate superhero for me has always been Stan Lee because he was this little guy who needed a job after World War II, and he ends up creating an entire universe.
Yes. Stan Lieber. What was it? Stan Lieber?
Yeah, that's right. Stan Lieber. Stan Lieber.
Many of the comic book characters, you know, the Jack Kirby's, Jerry Siegel, Joe Shuster, who created Superman, they were Jews. You know, it was like a metaphor.
They all were children of immigrants, exactly.
Yes, it was. Superman was the original illegal immigrant.
That's right. That's right.
You know, he did not go through customs. His spaceship went into Kansas. I mean, so, you know, he didn't turn out so bad.
I was going to say, I'm still wondering how Ma Kent sewed his suit, but okay, that's another story.
Yeah, you got to, you know, there's a little things you just got to let it go. But, you know, they were outsiders. And, of course, in Marvel in the 60s was the anti-hero. Yeah,
yeah,
but there was something about the being immigrant and being looking outside, you know, being considered an outsider, which appealed to people, especially the Marvel comics. They're just wonderful.
Still does to this day when we get right down to it. Are you really?
And I'm working on a graphic novel. Not a, it's a wrestling graphic novel. So
oh,
we just
you
finished
are a
it
renaissance
and we're
going
to go to market. Well, you know, we'll see. But it's fun. It's fun. I love
that's
what,
great.
Writing the graphic novel. It's just an interesting medium. It's just fun. It kind of takes me back to my childhood. I think anything you could do to stay 14 years old without the acne, you should do.
That, everyone on, as I'm looking on social media, everyone in light of Stan Lee's passing has been saying thank you for my childhood.
Yes, well, that's it.
Speaking of supervillains, when we talk about King David, the way you describe the piece, nowadays we're such a polarized society politically. Do you think both sides might be enthralled by your upcoming musical? Because the way you describe King David, we could be talking about a current president as well. You know, maybe he was good at one point, but he had far too many flaws and the power and all of that.
He did great things. But, you know, King David united the Jewish people. He defeated enemies. He was a remarkable, charismatic, brilliant leader. Was he a brilliant leader? Because he had these flaws.
Mm-hmm.
He had this dark side because he didn't care if he had to cut corners. I mean, is that the, you know, I think Obama disappointed people because they thought he was had to be holier than thou. And when he was just a politician from Chicago, you know, trying to cut a deal, it was like, oh, my God, how could you do that? Well, that's what they have to do. So sometimes I think it's not so much our leaders who fail us, but sometimes our expectations. Of course, now we have no expectations of anyone. It's just,
that's interesting.
You know,
you know what? That's that's another really fascinating thing. Yes, you know, we're expecting nothing, so anything is good.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. And you know, there was something back in the days of John Kennedy when the media covered for, you know, presidents and movie stars and role players. I mean, could any president now get away with having call girls splashing in the White House pool? Probably not. Or, you know, getting speedballs of medication for a condition which they kept.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Kennedy was a sick man.
Yeah.
We still don't know exactly how sick. We don't know exactly how much it influenced him. You know, is that FDR, go back to the 30s and 40s. He was not shown in his wheelchair.
No, you that's know, very now, true. He demanded all the newsreels to start it once he's at podiums.
Yeah. Now, is that bad? I don't know. I'm going to get in terrible trouble by people saying what's wrong with being in a wheelchair. But, and I believe, you know, there's two schools of thought in history. There's the presentism, where you see everything through the perspective of now, and historicism, understanding then. Back then, being in a wheelchair was considered a disability.
Right.
Now,
right.
That doesn't, you know, I'm not saying that's the proper perspective. And we needed strong leaders. So could we accept a strong leader who looked physically weak? Probably not. So what he did was correct. We shouldn't do it now. But that doesn't mean what he did then was necessarily wrong. And I think we need to be able to, you know, we've gotten to the stage in our society where merely explaining something makes you accused of accepting that point of view. Well, no, but we've got to understand. And I think as writers and as you know, in entertainment, as performers, we're allowed to go beyond that. We're allowed to say what we need to, what needs to be said, which, you know, in other professions, we're not allowed.
So you think because it's funny you say that, because even Cole Porter, eventually was in a wheelchair and walked with canes and whatever. And he too, he would have all his guests wait in one room while he was carried into the dining room
so that no one would see him hobble. Are you saying the, because we're talking Marvel superheroes, we're talking your novel, which again, like I say, shows the end of America on a certain level. Do you think we're reaching a point where, as much as we look up to people, we know who we're looking up to? I'm sure social media has something to do with that, but can we look at somebody and not think of them as perfect like we used to? Can someone in a wheelchair be president? Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I think it would be celebrated.
Okay.
I think it would be. I think that might be a good thing. I think in my novel, among the many things, social media is banned under the Anti-Narcissism Act. Because in this world of America, the family, having real relationships and loving someone, it doesn't matter who you are, you know, what you are. There's no mention of, you know, gay, straight, black, white, blah, blah, blah. It's just if you love someone, you work hard and you have your ethical, that's all that matters. So social media was banned because people out there, the 1,000 friends you have on Facebook are really not your friends. Some of them might be, but most of them are not your friends. And I think it's social media we have now, it's gone berserk because everyone thinks they're king.
Oh, of course.
Not everyone is qualified.
Of course.
Not everyone's opinion matters. So I don't even know what people are judged by anymore or what you could believe anymore. It's kind of the wheels are coming a little bit off the wagon. Now, it's not as bad as, say, the 1960s in a way. Which was, you know, I mean, America was, you know, melting down. But even so, despite the discord, there was a sense of what being an American meant. And I think increasingly we don't have a common definition, a common sharing of what it means to be an American. And that's very scary.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, lights out. If we lose America, you know, Americans are not going to, you know, sneak across borders of other countries. People come to us. We are still the shining city on the hill. Whatever your politics, whatever you think is wrong with the country, wrong with this president, the previous president, we still are the beacon of hope in a world where many countries do not have freedom and where Jay and Gary would be arrested after this interview for daring to speak their minds, right? And we, you know, but I think especially the younger generation, you see polls where millennials – have no, you know, truck with capitalism, who don't really think, you know, freedom of speech is such a big deal anymore. And once you don't think it's a big deal, once you're not willing to fight for it, you know, the game could be over.
You don't know what you have until you lose it.
That's right.
It sounds like your novel shows that to us in the simplest way. If you can't go see a baseball game, okay, what country are you living in?
That's right. And it can go. And as history shows that it can go and people... You know, we're shocked. Well, in Germany, it was such a vibrant, you know, wonderful, free country, and then it became a dictatorship.
And one, two,
you go on and on. Yeah, it doesn't take a lot. It really doesn't. I love the Amazon series, The Man in the High Castle. You know, based on the Philip Dick book, where America lost World War II to Japan and Germany. Well, we could have lost World War II. It wasn't preordained.
Wow.
And people have to, you know,
You know, it's so funny, but when you say that, okay, I'm 50 years old, and so all of this has been in my head my whole life. It's been pure history to me. So when you just said it wasn't preordained, how many people really take that into consideration?
None.
How many people sit there and say, okay, my simple thing of getting on a Facebook post of going and buying a newspaper, well, who buys newspapers, but of doing these things, it's amazing. It's amazing.
Yes, yes. And I'm sure there's a lot of countries where social media is banned.
I'm sure of that.
For sure.
Your pieces seem to reflect that. Your pieces seem to reflect that. Saving Stan, you know, this man wants to die. He's a millionaire and he wants to die. And you know, I'm sure there were people in the audience who sat there and said, what are you kidding? I want your money. I don't care if I'm in a chair. They don't realize the freedom of freedom. And it certainly sounds like that with your novel. What's the next step for the novel? Where's it going from here?
Well, I'm working on book two, which takes place, which starts 3 hours after book one ends.
Well,
and it's, you know, going to be another long book, but, you know, I didn't create a whole new genre, but I certainly breathed life into baseball science fiction. Most reviewers had said it's rare for baseball to be the center of a science fiction novel simply because people don't think baseball will make it into the future anyway. There was a poll maybe 3-4 months ago of sports fans now, and 56% of sports fans admit they never watch a baseball game. And this is not the general public. So, you know, baseball, because baseball is a slow game, and we live in a world where, you know, you have to answer your text within 7.1 seconds. And it also involves sentiment. And America is no longer sentimental. Think about it. We just can't be set. We can't get tears in our eyes over anything anymore. Wow. And there's something that's not good. You know, we all got to, and we all got to laugh at ourselves. You know, do you just stop fulminating? You know, if there'll be another election, there'll be another president, believe it or not. I mean, the Republic will stand. Just chill a little bit.
We should talk to Bill Maher, because I don't think he has that philosophy at the moment.
No,
Gary, thank you so much
for
words of wisdom. Here I was just going to talk about your amazing projects, and we got this sage wisdom. So thank you so much for all of that. All the best with all these projects. Please keep me posted on everything. And
I sure will.
When I get off the phone, I'm going to email you about when we could sit down and do drinks and talk about everything.
I would love that. And it's a pleasure to be on the Wizard of PRs.
Thank you very much. All the best. I'll talk to you soon, everyone. Ciao.
Bye-bye.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that brings us to the end of another podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. From me, Jay Michaels.
And me, Mary McCary.
We say have a good night. And if you got a couple of 20s burning a hole in your pocket, you can see a play, go to a cabaret, and now you can also buy a book. Thanks, gang. Ciao.
She's